So here we are. The best part of God's story. Wow. Where do I start? I mean, it's Jesus. There's so much I can say. Not just what the Bible tells us about him, but also all the stuff I know about him personally. You see, I know him. And talk about grace. For half of my adult life, I had no interest in God and his boundaries. I wanted to go it alone, make my own way, and I did. And it didn't turn out that well. Depressed, addicted to work and alcohol, empty, and not extra spiritual or extra anything, just seriously messed up and lost, I reached out to him and he took my hand. The rest is history. I could sit here and tell you story after story of how Jesus gave me a fresh start, healed my heart, taught me to trust him, and filled the emptiness inside me with his presence. After Jesus, life is still tough, but the good parts are even better, and there's joy even in the rough patches. I'm never alone. I have hope, no matter how bad things get, because whatever it is, it's not the end of the story. His story is now my story, and I would never want to go back. So where do I start? I'm going to start with what the Bible tells us about Jesus, because I can vouch that what it says about him in there is true, because I know him, close and personal. I invite you to get to know him too. So we'll start by looking at his biographies. Yep, biographies. There's four of them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're the first four books of the second part of the Bible called the New Testament. There's four of them because Jesus is so big, so wild, that no single one could capture all of him. So what we have are four different perspectives, which taken together give us an excellent picture of him. They're appropriately called the Gospels because they're the good news about Jesus the Christ or Jesus the Messiah. And trust me, they're really good news, not only for folks back in the first century, when he literally walked the earth as a human being, but also for all folks today because he's still with us by his Spirit. As the risen Messiah, King of kings and Lord of lords, back in his rightful place with God the Father. Remember where we left off in God's story? The Romans are in charge, and the people of Israel realize that they need a rescuer bigger than the emperor. So they turn to God and their Bible, the Old Testament, for some answers. Looking at how God has dealt with them in the past and reflecting on what the prophets have told them, they bank on God's grace once again and start to look for a Messiah, a God-sized rescuer who would intervene in history and save them, not only from Roman oppression, but someone who would also heal their sick, rebellious hearts once and for all. A rescuer who would give them back their land and who would make them the people from which God's rule, God's kingdom, would extend out into the rest of the world. Notice something here. This isn't wishful, pie in the sky, escapist kind of thinking. It's God. Life sucks. We need you right here, right now kind of thinking. We want you not only to heal our sick hearts, but also, and especially, we want our freedom, our land, and your kingdom, your rule on this planet right where we are. We don't want an escape from this world. We want your goodness to bust into all the bad and make it right. Their eyes are firmly fixed on a God who, in his grace, promised them a spiritual rescue, for sure, but also a rescue involving the entire planet and everything on it, God's kingdom on earth. Keep this in mind as we go. It's important. It's bigger. It's much more exciting than going to heaven when you die. As we're about to see, Jesus is about much more than rescuing souls so they can go to heaven. He's about rescuing the whole planet, literally all of creation, ushering in a whole new creation, a new world, a new people who know him, trust him, and live with him forever. The three themes brought to their ultimate conclusion. Think of everything I talked about in part two, the garden, and all the good God wanted for his creation, and turn it up 20 notches. This is exciting. This is a lot bigger than some take it or leave it, you do you and I'll do me, pie in the sky spirituality. If it's true, it's got everything to do with, well, everything and everybody. So, back to the story. Now, Israel, looking at these promises given by the prophets, couldn't wrap its mind around what it all meant. So all kinds of ideas emerged about what this promised Messiah and his kingdom would look like, exactly what the Messiah would do, and how he would do it. None of the Messiah proposals on offer quite got it, because despite their differences, all of them relied in some way or another, to some degree or another, on human ideas about kingdoms and power. We've already talked about this, the fact that we live in a broken world. The fact that all human expressions of power, even the best of them, are distorted by evil. Human power always involves some degree of backbiting, jostling to be first, dominating others, and controlling them. Human power eventually disappoints, falls short, and crushes somebody. That's how it works in a broken world. The fact that we love Game of Thrones and can relate to all the intrigue, power grabbing, and backstabbing, and the more important fact that we're absolutely thrilled when good triumphs over evil, just proves my point. We eat the stuff up because we're wired for God and his perfectly good kingdom. And we know, even in our brokenness, the difference between bad kingdoms and good ones. We ache for good to triumph, precisely because we're wired for God. Jesus comes to show us what God's kingdom looks like. He comes to show us a totally different kind of power, the kind of power that brings life and peace. So, back to the story. Israel had plenty of real-life examples of God's power. His creative power, his power to rescue, and his power to judge rebellion and evil for what it is. It's all there in the Old Testament. The Old Testament is crystal clear that God is the only God and the only King of the earth, as perfectly just as he is perfectly compassionate. What was a little more murky, as far as Israel's understanding went, was how God's justice, compassion, and mercy fit with his power, especially when it came to all the other nations, especially Rome, who basically ignored God and his boundaries. Remember, they're working with a purely human understanding of power. So they're thinking, would the Messiah obliterate the Romans? Would he force them to their knees? Would he subject them to Israel and its leaders? What place, if any, would they have in God's kingdom? Despite centuries of real-life lessons, God wasn't done teaching Israel, the nations, and us about his power. Another totally unprecedented, real demonstration of God's power, something like Jesus' death on the cross and his resurrection, was needed. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Back to Israel. There's a couple of things going on here that help better understand the dynamic between Jesus, the Messiah they actually got, and Israel's leaders, the Messiah they wanted. First, remember, I talked about how even good things become twisted when we absolutize them, make them the answer to every problem, making them God in place of the God. Well, the political and religious leaders at that time, though they had tossed their man-made idols after the exile, turned around and set up other gods in their hearts, namely themselves, as the guardians of the law. In their pride, they became the solution to all their problems. What do I mean? Basically, the thinking was, if we keep the law as we understand it, with all the extra rules and traditions we put around it to make sure it's done just right, then God will send us a Messiah who will defeat all our enemies and put us in charge. Second, this line of thinking blinded Israel's leaders to certain important descriptions of the Messiah revealed by the prophets. Namely, that the Messiah would suffer, bear the full weight of humanity's rebellion against God, and be put to death. Definitely not the picture of the powerful victory that they had in mind. It didn't fit the narrative, so it was easy to ignore. Third, they forgot about the spiritual dimension of evil. Evil as a power in its own right. No amount of rule-keeping could even make a dent in that. Anyways, God isn't even interested in rules. He's interested in hearts. Just as even the quote-unquote good person doesn't measure up to the perfect goodness of God, neither can any quote-unquote good nation, religious or not, measure up. Any created thing that sees itself as the answer to everything joins the spiritual forces in rebellion against God. Israel's leaders couldn't see this, even when Jesus called them out on it over and over again. The authorities were too caught up in their own story to see what God was doing right in front of their eyes. The Messiah God sends them, Jesus of Nazareth, isn't the one they wanted. He didn't fit the narrative. First, he's basically a no-name nobody from an obscure town in the southern part of ancient Palestine, no man's land. Second, despite his seemingly unimpressive roots, he's running around doing things he has no business doing. The no-name Jew Jesus, so they thought, is running around Palestine healing people, feeding the crowds. What's up with that? Teaching them. Horror of horrors, that's our job, were the religious authorities, and basically showing everyone who wanted to know what the kingdom of God is all about. How dare he? What does he know? Third, he's associating with the wrong kind of people, aka folks we, the religious authorities, don't approve of. Eating with lowlifes and hanging out with losers. What's he doing with them people? Fourth, he's claiming to be God's son. What a joke. He's a no-name nobody from no man's land. Fifth, if that's not enough, he's exposing and confronting the spiritual forces in rebellion against God who have been menacing creation since their debut in the garden. This is the clearest sign of a God-sized Messiah. Here's a dude with real power, God-sized power. How can this be, the leaders think? He must be in cahoots with those dark forces. Sixth, the crowds love him. Oh no, serious threat to our authority. Well, the crowds do love him, at least for the time being, at least until he challenges their preconceptions about God's kingdom, at least until he's arrested, tried, and sentenced. But the religious and political authorities, on the whole, can only see a threat to their power. So, then and now, it all comes down to the question of power, what it looks like, how it works, and especially who has it. Think of it this way. Who or what has the power to write your story? Is it an addiction, past hurts, shame, guilt, the American dream? Social media, career, the expectations of others, the need to be noticed and accepted, a chronic illness? Or is it the inevitability of death? You know, the grab all you can before you die kind of thinking. In a broken world, something or someone is driving you. The freedom to write your own story is an illusion. I'll say it again. The idea that you're somehow immune from the brokenness of the world you live in is a pipe dream. Something's got you. Something is driving you. And if it's not Jesus, it's something broken. Trying to fix brokenness with something broken is like the blind leading the blind. Both will fall into the pit. That's Jesus' saying, not mine, but it's a good one. Then and now, Jesus blows all our ideas of power out of the water, turning all of them upside down, inside out. He defeats evil and death and brings in a new creation where all persons who trust in him are given a fresh start, a new heart, and the power, his power, to resist the power of a broken world. Everyone who trusts in Jesus has the power to resist the power of any created thing to drive their story. Even death is stripped of its power to be the inevitable end of the story. Wow, I've gotten ahead of myself, but it's Jesus. It's impossible not to. So let's unpack this. Back to Messiah Jesus and his biographies. But before I do that, I've got to put on the table the question that always comes up when talking about Jesus, and the fact that he's fully God and fully human, and that he was executed as a criminal on a Roman cross, and then after 3 days rose from the dead. I mean, that's wild. Is he for real? First of all, Jesus is mentioned by the Roman historian and senator Tacitus, who records that he was crucified by Pontius Pilate, Roman proconsul of ancient Judea, during the reign of the Roman emperor Tiberius. Tacitus also records that the Jewish people called him the Christ or the Messiah. So here we have historical evidence that Jesus existed from folks who weren't particularly thrilled with him, but he's there in their records. Second, two of the Jesus biographies in the Bible are written by eyewitnesses, people close to Jesus who lived with him and who heard and saw everything he did. The Gospel of Mark is based on the testimony of that kind of an eyewitness. Think of it this way. If these folks had had smartphones, they would have been in the best position to record everything Jesus said and did in real time. The oddball out, the person who wrote the Gospel of Luke, tells us right in the beginning that he himself carefully investigated all the Jesus business, including the eyewitnesses and their reports, before he put all the evidence together in his historical account. We know from studying ancient Greek and Roman biographers and historians that they were more like modern-day journalists than modern-day biographers, because they literally went to the places they were writing about and talked with the eyewitnesses who knew and saw the people and events they were recording. So according to ancient history and biography writing conventions, the Gospels pass the smell test. They're not myths, fairy tales, or legends. Ancient people would have known this since these types of fictional stories follow different writing conventions. Like us, they could tell the difference between a novel and a historical account. Third, the fact that millions of people over more than 2,000 years have read the Gospels, believed what they read is true, and can testify to that fact suggests that perhaps we should give the Gospels a chance and read them. These people can't all be delusional, can they? Fourth, Jesus is a person. I know him. I'm not delusional. I invite you to give him a chance and get to know him. And see for yourself if the biographies in the Bible match up. Okay, let's leave it at that and move on. Back to God's story in the Gospels. As I said, Jesus is not the Messiah Israel's leaders wanted. So what kind of Messiah is he? In the Gospel of John, the fourth biography, Jesus is identified with grace. He's the grace, remember, grace the undeserved, unmerited gift. He's the grace given by God to humanity in place of the grace already given through the law. I talked about grace, the law, and the temple in the last part. With Jesus, we're right back to grace. It's all about grace. The words in place of tells us that God's doing something totally new in the grace department. It's bigger and better than what he's already done with Abraham and Israel. How so? Let's look at the three themes. 1, know God. 2, trust his perfect goodness and act like you trust it. 3, live in his perfect peace, live in his presence. Remember, it's all about God reaching out to rebellious humanity to bring us back into relationship with himself. With Jesus, talk about coming down to our level, living with us, and showing us who God is. It can't get any clearer. Grace to the nth degree. Jesus is God in flesh and bone. He's fully human and fully God. In part 4, I talked about how God stepped down from his glorious throne room to dwell in a temple built by humans. With Jesus, God takes the gracious move into a tiny bungalow to a whole other level. He empties himself of all the perks of being God. I'm going to say it again. He gives up all the perks of being God, takes on human skin, and becomes one of us in all ways but one. Jesus never stops trusting. He never rebels. He's not like any other human since the garden. Although Jesus is tempted over and over again to choose some created thing over God, he never does. In Jesus, in all he says and all he does during his life on earth, we see the perfect goodness of God, his Father, in action. Now, we're made in the image of God. We've talked about that already. Jesus is the very image of God. He's God in flesh and bone. But he lives among us as one of us. Let that sink in for a minute. The fact that he's born in ancient Palestine as a first century Jewish man is not as important as the fact that he's human. That's the fundamental thing that binds all people together, our humanness, our being made in the image of God. The particularities of time, place, sex, and nationality are important only because Jesus is an actual historical person. Remember I said that we should think of Israel as a sample of humanity in general? The same holds true for Israel's mixed responses to Jesus, their Messiah. They reflect human responses to him in general. The religious and political authorities, with a few notable exceptions, see him as a threat to their power. They don't like him and can't wait to get rid of him. Regular folk are mixed in their responses. Some love the miracles he does, but run the other way when he starts talking about persecution, bearing a cross, and leaving everything to follow him. Others are happy to follow him as long as he fits their idea of what the Messiah should do for them. Once he doesn't perform as expected, once he challenges their preconceptions, once he's arrested, they're out of there. Some, namely Jesus' disciples, hang in there, but barely. So, as far as the three themes we've been following go, Jesus brings them to their ultimate goal. As I already said, Jesus literally is God living among us. No temple with all its protocols and sacrifices. God does something totally crazy with Jesus. He makes himself fully and completely accessible to the limited broken humans he created. That's a dangerous proposition, putting himself at our mercy. But he does it anyway. In Jesus, God is made fully known. In Jesus, we can see exactly what a God-centered life looks like. He fully trusts God, his Father, even to the point of going to the cross, trusting that his Father will do what he promised to do, raise him from the dead. Like us, living in a broken world, Jesus' trust is tested by all the opportunities he had not to trust, including all the temptations to skip the cross, ditch the human skin, call on all the perks of being God, and destroy his enemy. Zap, gone. But he doesn't. He does what he's supposed to do and takes on the shame, the injustice, and the pain of a Roman execution. Okay, wonderful. The three themes we've been following all come together in Jesus. But what does this have to do with all that stuff in the Old Testament? And what does it have to do with me? The answers to these questions get to the point of the cross. Old Testament first. Jesus wouldn't make much sense without all the stuff that happens before him. He's the promised Messiah that Israel's turbulent history points to. Think of it this way. The Old Testament leaves the three themes hanging. It's the opening chapters of a story crying for a climax. God shows Israel who he is, and they still don't get it. They still don't trust him. He's with them in the temple, but they tick him off with all their constant idol worship, including child sacrifice. And he leaves. God gives them good, life-giving boundaries, but they would rather do what the other nations do. Their leaders lead like the rulers around them. Mercy, compassion, and justice fall by the wayside. They oppress their people. There's no peace between Israel and their land. It vomits them out. Then, when they think it can't get any worse, here comes Rome. God's kingdom is nowhere to be seen. This can't be it. And it's not. The climax of the story is Jesus, because after him, nothing is the same. I'll say that again. After Jesus, nothing is the same. That means more than 2,000 years later, whether we know it or not, care about it or not, believe it or not, things have changed for good on a cosmic scale. We can choose to be part of that change or not. That change exists as a fact, regardless of anyone's personal belief or preference. Jesus changes everything because, unlike the law and the temple, though they're good and are great examples of God's grace, he's the only one that can get to the root of human rebellion, the spiritual powers that are in rebellion against God. Remember the serpent in the garden? Well, Jesus crushes its head. Before I talk about how Jesus crushes these powers, a couple of words about what these powers are. Satan, God's number one nemesis, appears a few times in the Old Testament. We've already met him in Genesis in the garden. He came in the guise of the talking serpent. In the book of Job, Satan tests Job's integrity by claiming that Job trusts God only because things are going well for him. So in a rubber hits the road moment, poor Job loses everything. Just in case you're wondering, Job passes the test. Satan also appears in Zechariah, a book written by a prophet, who tells us that God rebukes him, meaning Satan, giving us a preview of his ultimate fate, getting his head crushed by Jesus. In the New Testament, we learn that these spiritual powers led by Satan are angels who rebelled against God and as a result were booted out of heaven, out of God's presence, and cast to the earth. Appropriately, Satan is called the prince of the world, and his team is referred to in various ways as principalities, powers, dominions, thrones, and authorities. These things are realities just like God and his kingdom are a reality. The words I just mentioned are kingdom and power words and point to both spiritual power in itself and to the fact that these powers stand behind, over, above human power. They're spiritual powers, but they're at work in the everyday world that we live in. Another way of looking at this is to say that all of our societal structures and institutions are part of the broken world they exist in. So all of them share in that brokenness. Let's be real. It's as plain as day. Just read the headlines. The New Testament just explains something all of us are perfectly aware of. Israel learned this the hard way. They learned that even their religious institutions and leaders can be and were co-opted by spiritual powers greater than them. Same for us. So, how did Jesus crush these powers? Jesus shows them for what they are, not God and not in charge. For all their rebelliousness, they don't get the final word. At the same time, Jesus' death on the cross shows the what of God's power, the what that makes God's power unmatched by anything we've ever seen or could ever imagine. We can't see past our noses unless God shows us. And he did. Here's what I mean. Recall how I said that the religious authorities were looking for our particular kind of Messiah? So along comes Jesus, who looks nothing like that, and who in fact calls out the religious leaders for making the law and the temple all about them and their power over the people. He calls them hypocrites, who pretend to know God and to trust him, when in fact they're blind to the fact that God is doing something new. And rather than trusting God, they trust in themselves as the descendants of Abraham, the keepers of the law, the holy ones who deserve to rule because they are so holy, so above everybody else. Jesus tells them their hearts, just like everyone else's, are turned to evil all the time. They need God's grace, just like the next guy. They need to be healed and transformed. Needless to say, this doesn't go over well. They don't want to hear it, and they plot a way to get rid of him permanently. So what do? They get Rome to side with them. They stir up the crowds and manipulate Pontius Pilate to do what they want. Now, in terms of a power play, this is brilliant. The Romans crucify Jesus on trumped-up charges, brought before a kangaroo court, and he dies like a criminal. Looks like the end of a wannabe Messiah. The powers that be, both the human ones and the spiritual ones that stand behind them, they celebrate. They got what they wanted. They're in control. As Jesus hung there naked and dying, the Roman soldiers taunt him as the pretend king of the Jews, casting lots for his clothes, while Israel's leaders and passersby jeer at him, telling him to save himself if he's the Messiah. And Jesus could have, but didn't. Behind the scenes, the spiritual powers celebrate their power to corrupt human hearts into killing a perfectly innocent man who did nothing more than heal people and teach them about God's kingdom. They're thinking, wow, looks like God can't get these rebellious humans to see anything clearly, no matter how many times and in how many ways he shows them, including sending his son. They prefer rebellion. They prefer to be like us. They prefer doing it their own way. We've won again, just like in the garden and every minute since then. And then it happens. 3 days after the end of a wannabe Messiah, God the Father raises Jesus from the dead, never to die again. What I say next is key. Right before Jesus went to the cross, he asked his father to forgive his executioners because he said they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know. They couldn't know. Because who he really is and what he did on the cross doesn't become clear until his resurrection. Jesus' resurrection is God's yes to the no of Satan's and humanity's rebellion and to the finality of death. The spiritual powers may have thought they got the upper hand, that they were powerful enough to get humans to execute the God-man Jesus. When Jesus' dead body, trust me, no one can survive a Roman crucifixion. When Jesus' dead body goes into the tomb, it looks like God's rescue plan failed. But little did anyone know, including the spiritual powers, that those folks who would see the risen Jesus, touch his resurrection body, and eat with him, yes, eat with him, would spark a movement that would grow into a worldwide community of people who would turn to God, get back into relationship with him, and experience the fullness of his power, his goodness, and his grace smack dab in the middle of a broken world. Talk about a successful stealth mission, a coup de grace right under Satan's nose. I mean, it's crazy. What happened after the resurrection is a historical fact. The community of Jesus' followers grew and swelled. What happened after the resurrection is as true today as it was over 2,000 years ago. Thousands of years after Jesus rose, people continue to get who Jesus is and what he did because he's a person they can know, follow, and learn from because he's still present in the world by his Spirit. Wow. It gets even better. Jesus is the climax of a story that has been going on since creation. He's the blessing to all the world that God first gave to Abraham. Jesus' death and resurrection reverses all the consequences of the great mess up. With Jesus, we can know God. Through Jesus, we can get back in relationship with God. Because of Jesus, we have the power to trust God and obey him. We have the power to live within God's boundaries each time the rubber hits the road through the trials of life. With Jesus, we have God's presence in us by his Spirit. That's right. Through Jesus, the heart turned to evil all the time is healed, is transformed, is filled with God's Spirit. As a consequence, we know we are God's beloved. We know our true identity. That's what all of this has to do with you and me. Through Jesus, we can know God's goodness up close and personal because we can have his presence within us. And so we can live a life of trust that is radically different from the brokenness of the world. The brokenness of the world need no longer write our story because its hold on us is broken by the power of the cross. Now, the key phrase is, need no longer write our story, because the choice is ours. The cross shows us that God's power is all about drawing people to himself, not by coercion or manipulation, but by the power of his love. In the face of humanity's rebellion, God doesn't destroy his creation, but instead offers forgiveness, restoration, and peace. The opposite of what rebellious humans deserve. From the cross, the greatest example of the rejection of God and his goodness, flows a river of grace. We can choose to drink from that river or not. So, with Jesus, the open invitation to God's awesome end-of-history party remains open. Well, at least for now. Jesus is coming back. Remember I said that we are living in the time between Jesus' resurrection and his return? Yes, he's coming back. And that's when God's promise of a complete and final restoration of peace on a new earth will be actualized. The promise will become reality. In the meantime, those who have said yes to Jesus live in the certain hope that he will return, that he will bring a new, clean, fresh, fertile earth, and that all people will be raised from the dead. No more tears, no more sorrow, no more death. A totally new creation. We know from the Old Testament, and especially from Jesus' resurrection, that God keeps all of his promises. That's why it's a certain hope. So, why the delay? To give everyone, literally every person, the chance to RSVP. When Jesus does come back, the divorce will be final. Now, I don't claim to know the mind of God. He's God, and I'm not. What I do know is that God is merciful beyond belief and that he's also perfectly just. So I'm not going to pretend to know all the terms and conditions of the final divorce and exactly how it's all going to play out in God's courtroom. All I know for sure is that those who say yes to Jesus will live on the new earth with him forever. Not as disembodied souls floating around in the clouds, but as people with real resurrected bodies that will never decay and die, on a real, equally glorious planet, doing real culture-creating things in all of our racial and ethnic diversity. With one caveat, no more rebellious spiritual powers. These were exposed for what they are by the cross, created rebellious beings that have chosen to write their own alternative ending to the story, but who do not have the last word as far as creation goes. And it's pretty easy to imagine what this alternative ending to the story will be like. Life lived forever in a world devoid of God and his goodness, a world full of strife, self-interest, violence, domination, and backbiting. An eternal existence on a dry, exploited, and infertile planet where God's perfect peace is completely absent and unknown. Think of the Hunger Games on steroids, an unending battle that no one ever wins. Because God's story is still unfolding, the opportunity to drink from the river of grace still stands. Remember I said that God is a person? He's neither a spirituality nor a religion. He's the creator king of the universe. This means that saying yes to Jesus isn't just a personal preference. It also means that his boundaries aren't just personal beliefs. You do you and I'll do me doesn't work here. Because God and all he did and does is the absolute for all of creation, including all people. But, and this is equally important, this also means that folks who say yes to Jesus aren't extra special, extra good, or extra anything. They're just simply broken people who have chosen to drink from the river of grace that is available to everybody. Humility and Jesus go together. One more thing. Walking with Jesus in a broken world doesn't completely erase the walking blues. Life is still full of challenges. God's story is still unfolding in a world that is waiting for Jesus to return. But we have the choice to face the challenges of life with the resurrection power of Jesus or with our own power, which is nothing more than a reflection of whatever form of brokenness happens to be driving your story. I don't know about you, but the first clearly is the better alternative. Now, I've been on both sides of this choice. I know what it's like to walk with Jesus, and I know what it's like to go it alone. Like I said in the beginning, my choice to go it alone didn't go well for me. I was trapped in my addictions and by the hurts of past abuse. These things were writing my story, and they were definitely not life-giving. I felt like a wild animal in a trap, trying to get free by chewing my leg off. Saying yes to Jesus freed me from their power. There's no other way to explain it. I got a fresh start, a life free of alcohol and the need to constantly prove myself. Instead of being the worthless, stupid, and ugly person I was taught that I was, I became God's beloved daughter. An identity I know can never be taken from me by anybody, anything, or any circumstance of life. This is who I am. I've learned that walking with Jesus makes you more like him. And who doesn't want to be like Jesus? Look, he eats with them people. Look, I had my issues with the church for the longest time. I just didn't want anything to do with them. I had all these trust issues, and I thought that Christians were just full of themselves. But Jesus is not the church, whatever image comes to mind when I say that. He's Jesus. The fact that sometimes some of his followers screw up and say and do really stupid, hurtful things doesn't mean Jesus does or that he will. They're people. He's God. He's Jesus. It's really that simple. Remember the image of God and how they got blurry and distorted after the great mess up? Well, the healing and transformation of the heart that happens when a person says yes to Jesus results in that image gradually becoming clearer and clearer. That's an awesome gift of grace. By walking with Jesus, I've learned that facing all the rubber hits the road challenges of life with the power and grace of the cross works like one of those magic microfiber cloths. You know those cloths that you use to clean the screens on your electronic devices. You know what I'm talking about. Walking with Jesus works like that. It works by polishing away all the tarnish and crud that clouds the reflection of the image of God in us. It works to gradually make us ready for the coming end of history party, clean, dressed, and ready when Jesus comes back. And there's a whole bunch of people who can testify to this. Look, I've taken many drinks of grace from the river, more than I can count. I've learned how to hear, trust, and follow the Spirit's leading in choosing God in His ways instead of the ways of a broken world. And like I said, there's a whole community of folks who can testify to the same thing. Walking with Jesus makes everything we say and do that reflects God's goodness, no matter how small and insignificant we think it is. It makes it significant and meaningful simply because it becomes part of God's big unfolding story. Also, no matter how bad things get, I can hold on and move forward because I know that at the end, the river of grace that flows from the cross will flow into every aspect of creation, bringing healing and life to every broken, dead thing. This certain hope has the power to transform even the worst of situations. No matter how bad things get, it's not the end. There's more, much more, and it's all good. I know what it's like to be a beloved daughter of God. That's who I am, and I'm not going back. There's a place for you in God's story. The invitation is open. Jesus is holding out his hands to you. All you have to do is tell him you're sorry for rebelling and turning your back to him and say, "Yes, Jesus, I want to be part of your story. I want to be part of the new creation you are bringing to reality." If you want access to the river, if you want your story to be part of God's story, if you want to know what it's like to be God's beloved one, you need to say yes to God through Jesus. He's the way, the truth, and the life. If you would like to hang out with other folks looking to get to know Jesus better, Folks who want to hear more about God's story and be part of it, come and see what River of Grace is about. We're not what you would typically call a church. We're not a building offering a bunch of programs and events. We meet weekly in small cells of 4 to 12 people to talk about how our own personal stories find a place in God's story. We meet to encourage one another in our walk with Jesus, to laugh, pray, and share some food. There's room for everyone. It doesn't matter if you're just getting to know Jesus, have been AWOL and want to come back, have been walking with Jesus for a while, or just want to check out the whole Jesus thing for the first time. We see ourselves as a community of thirsty folks, ready and willing to show other thirsty folks where they can get a long, cool drink of grace. For us, it's all about God's story, all about relationships and grace. And we don't go to church on Sunday, whatever image that conjures up in your mind when I say that. When we all get together to worship, we celebrate God and the fact that we're His beloved. We remember who we are, our true identity. We remember God's story. We celebrate the fact that we're part of it, and we thank Jesus for the cross and His awesome grace. Come and see.